And so now for the first real talk of the day. Which is Victor, which is not Boo, but amazing. We'll be talking about monoliths and very old monoliths, almost as old as this dev room. Which I'm very curious to hear about because I'm also dealing with very old code, so a round of applause.
Welcome to my talk on modularizing a 10-year monolith. My name is Victor Lubaslavsky. I've been in tech for over 25 years, and I'm currently a principal software engineer at Fleet Device Management. At Fleet, we make endpoint telemetry for corporate security teams and device management for corporate IT teams. So in my current job, it took me roughly a year to figure out the code base, get familiar with the programming language, and understand our business domain. So around that time, I started to notice a consistent issue whenever working on our service package. The service package was the biggest one in our code base, and whenever I was recompiling a test in this package, it took roughly 30 seconds. So if I modified one character in a string, it took roughly 30 seconds to recompile the package and its unit tests. So I did a little digging. The Go programming language is known for fast compile times. However, the linking of all the packages was dominating the compile. From this analysis, the issue was obvious. The service package was just too big and had too many dependencies. I asked myself a simple question. What am I actually trying to do here? I'm not trying to fight the build system or wrestle with a giant package. I'm just trying to write good software. And it shouldn't take 30 seconds of self-therapy every time I change a string literal. So if I just want to write good software, what needs to change? I want a code base that feels light, understandable, and fast. One that helps me think instead of slowing me down. And I realized the only way to get there was to make the code base itself smaller. So we tried modularizing. Next, let's discuss our first attempt at modularization, where, as you might guess, things didn't quite go as smooth as we hoped. Let's talk about our code base. Fleet Device Management is primarily MIT licensed open source. We also maintain a small set of advanced features in a clearly separated directory under a different license. Our code base is roughly 10 years old with over 500,000 lines of Go backend code. This is a much simplified picture of the core of our server code. We have a single huge Go package for the API layer. It's our service package. It includes controllers and the service containing our business logic. The API layer calls the persistence layer. The persistence layer is another huge Go package. It constructs the SQL queries and executes them against our MySQL database. We also have an in-memory cache, a React frontend, a CLI, and a bunch of other components which are not pictured here. So at one of our engineering all hands meetings, I gave a presentation. I described how we could scale our code base to be a more modular architecture. The core idea of my presentation was that when working on a new major feature, we could create a new module, a vertical slice. This new vertical slice would mirror the structure of the legacy code. We would actually organize it exactly like the legacy code. That way, engineers would still roughly know where things are. And this actually looks exactly like a microservice, but still within a single compiled binary. My presentation seemed to land, and I felt confident enough to try it on a real feature. So shortly afterwards, we started working on a new feature. And this new feature seemed like an ideal candidate to try the new modularization approach. The feature was Android MDM, mobile device management. I created the new structure for the Android support, I created new packages and a dedicated directory. Most of the work was actually untangling several common parts so they could be reused between the legacy code and the new Android feature. I put up the PR, the pull request, and it just sat there. Our guidance is to review and merge PRs within 24 hours, but no one wanted to touch this one. In retrospect, I should have done a better job communicating to the team that I was actually going to do what I proposed in my earlier presentation. Some engineers felt surprised by the changes. They didn't feel like they had a voice in the approach. They didn't have an opportunity to speak up. So facing this resistance, I backtracked. I decided to take a step back and unsplit the MySQL layer so all requests would still go to the same MySQL schema. I also wrote two ADRs, architectural decision records, one to split the API layer and one to split the persistence layer for this Android feature. The ADR to split the API layer was approved, but the ADR to split the persistence layer was rejected. Engineers voiced their concerns. Their feedback was consistent. This felt risky, confusing, and too big to do all at once. So I reverted the persistence layer changes. The new API layer now talked to the same large shared persistent package as the rest of the code base. And at that point, I moved off the feature and delivery pressure took over. Without sustained architectural ownership, the Android code slowly seeped back into the legacy system. So what do we have now? The picture roughly shows what we have. Certainly at a high level, the code base doesn't appear very modular. Arguably, it's even more complex and harder to maintain than it was before. In practice, there's no clear separation between the legacy code and the Android feature. So next, let's discuss what we learned from our first attempt. I keep rediscovering that talking to people takes time and there's no shortcut. Real time, meetings, follow-ups, side conversations. And the bigger the organization, the slower that loop gets. We also can't rely only on who speaks up first. Early voices are often smart and well-intentioned, but they don't represent everyone. To build real consensus, we have to actively solicit feedback, especially in one-on-ones and smaller forums. To succeed, we need strong commitment, both from engineers and managers, to the architecture and to the specific boundaries we're proposing. Without that commitment, engineers naturally revert to old patterns and architectural compromises creep back in. And without management support, short-term delivery pressure wins over long-term structure. Here's a small example. When I said modules, I meant architectural modules, cohesive code with clear boundaries. But some people thought I meant Go modules. Nobody was wrong, we just weren't using the same language, and it took a face-to-face conversation to realize that. We thought the hard part was the architecture. It turned out the hard part were the conversations. Let's move on to the second lesson. What is an architectural change anyway? That sounds like a straightforward question, but in practice, it turns out to be one of the most political questions in engineering. Here's what we saw in reality. Architectural changes in our code base rarely showed up as architecture work. Instead, they went in as part of feature work. If you framed your change as part of feature work and included it in a PR with other feature changes, it moved, even if it broke existing architectural patterns. After all, we needed to get all the feature changes in quickly. Features are what make money for the company. But if you framed your change as a standalone architectural improvement, it stalled. It stalled because it was prioritized behind feature work. It stalled because engineers wanted to have bigger discussions around it. And it stalled because it wasn't providing immediate value to the company. So what's the main lesson here about architectural changes? If you don't define how architecture is allowed to change, it changes anyway. And often it changes behind your back. Let's move on to the third lesson. One thing we were missing was clear ownership. In a modular system, not every API endpoint belongs cleanly to a single service. Some endpoints mostly orchestrate work across multiple services. And this was true for us because the new Android feature still needed to talk to legacy code. The mistake was leaving that orchestration unowned. Every API point still needs a clear home, a specific module, and a specific team that's responsible for it. Even if the endpoint is just glue, someone has to own that glue. So where are we at this point? The first attempt didn't quite succeed. We still have the pain points of a large, tightly coupled code base. But hopefully we learned a few things. Now we have experience. So where to go from here? At this point, I realized the importance of the people part in architecture, and I felt like I couldn't convince the company on my own. I still didn't feel like an architecture expert. The first attempt was kind of a mess, so why would other engineers take my next proposal seriously and not see it as just another crazy idea? I needed someone else's help. I needed something like an appeal to authority. I needed to find someone else that had already done this transition, and I needed to analyze the way they approached it. Unfortunately, I did not find any large open source Go projects making a transition to a modular monolith. So as far as I know, we're the first large open source Go project doing this. Yay us. The next best reference was GitLab. GitLab runs a Ruby on Rails monolith, which they decided to break up into a modular monolith. They documented this decision publicly, and it turned my proposal from a crazy idea into a proven pattern. We weren't trying to invent something new. We were trying to follow a trail that was already there. Next, how to start? This time, there was no obvious new feature to anchor the modularization work. So we had several internal discussions with the engineering team. We aligned on domain-driven design and bounded context. But the hard question was where to draw that first boundary. I looked at our code organization, had a few conversations with my AI friend, and proposed several ways to slice the monolith. As you can imagine, this process is a lot to get your head around, trying to tease apart a 10-year-old system into self-contained modules. I felt like I was barely scratching the surface. I felt like I was surely missing a lot of the details and edge cases. There was a lot of unknowns. Starting a modularization effort with anything beyond the bare minimum seemed risky. All the engineers generally agreed that we wanted to do an incremental approach. We ultimately agreed on activity audit. This context is about recording things that had already happened in our system. For example, recording when a new user was created, when a new host enrolled, when the key configuration was changed, and a ton of other activities. Next, I wrote up a detailed architectural decision record and put it up for review by the team. Here's the link in case someone can't wait to dive into the details. Again, this ADR was framed as a pilot. This is the first bounded context we were creating before a bigger rollout. Several times I wondered where this whole thing was going to go anywhere. Sometimes I felt like everyone was on board. Other times I felt like I kept running into a brick wall. I also felt I was deep in the weeds and details of this re-architecture. I didn't quite see the full picture myself, and I had a suspicion that other engineers didn't either. I needed to convince myself and others why we were doing this. I needed an argument, and I needed to use it not just once, but every chance I got. So when I talked to the team, I roughly framed it like this. Every successful engineering org eventually hits the same wall. The monolith grows beyond what humans can safely understand. At that point, teams start colliding with each other's changes, ownership gets fuzzy, and small changes become risky. We're already seeing that, and that's not a failure of the people, it's a failure of the structure. Modularization isn't about process or slowing anyone down, it's about creating clear boundaries and ownership so teams can move fast with confidence as the system continues to grow. All right, now let's talk about the actual architecture. The high-level idea is almost the same as where we started with the first attempt. The new feature or new bounded context will be in its own module with its own controller, service, and persistent layers. The controllers and service will be able to call methods on other services in other bounded contexts. However, they will not be able to access the persistence layer of another bounded context. Here's the directory structure, directory layout of the bounded context. The service and MySQL directories match the API layer and the persistence layer from the previous diagram. The integration test down here should be able to fully test this bounded context without requiring parts from the rest of the application. Testing this bounded context with other bounded contexts will be done at a higher level integration test. I can talk about the decisions that went into this for a while, so catch me after the session if you'd like to dive deeper. Now let's talk about the decision not to split the database schema. When people hear modular monolith, they often assume that means multiple databases. We deliberately did not do that. We kept a single schema. Our problems weren't database scale or load. They were unclear ownership, broad service layers, and code that was hard to reason about. Splitting the database wouldn't have fixed that. It just would have added operational complexity and new failure modes. Splitting a database is one of the most expensive architectural decisions you can make, and it freezes boundaries. We were still learning where those boundaries should be. So we modularized the code first, preserved optionality, and decided we'd only split the database later if scaling actually required it. Now, everywhere we turned, we heard recommendations to use ports and adapters. However, a lot of our business logic lives in SQL, so pretending the database is just an adapter doesn't make sense for us. Ports and adapters doesn't work for our system as a whole, but one idea from it fits extremely well. That idea, bounded contexts do not share domain models directly. Any cross-context communication must go through an explicit owned contract. In practice, that means explicit module boundaries. Now, earlier I talked about how we ended up with large packages. When a shared common package is used for cross-context communication, it creates a specific problem. When two bounded contexts share the same common types, they're no longer independent. A change in one context silently changes the behavior of the other. At that point, the boundary only exists in our heads, not in the code. So for cross-context communication, shared packages aren't reuse. Instead, they're hidden coupling. That's why we require explicit owned contracts at context boundaries. When one bounded context needs something from another, it doesn't reach into its internals. Instead, the providing context exposes a small explicit interface along with the types that belong to that interface. Those interfaces and types are owned by the provider. They live with the bounded context and they evolve on its terms. Other contexts can depend on the contract, but not on the implementation. This is what makes the boundary real in code, not just in our heads. Now, sometimes a new bounded context still needs data or behavior that lives in legacy code. In those cases, we don't let the new code talk to legacy directly. Instead, we introduce an anti-corruption layer, or ACL. The ACL is the only place that understands both worlds. It translates legacy concepts, types, and quirks into something the new context can work with safely. Notice that this ACL package is outside the new bounded context. It keeps legacy semantics from leaking into the new code, and it gives us a clear seam we can replace or delete later. The goal of the ACL isn't elegance, it's containment. Now let's continue with the story. Before we changed any code, we had one big issue. Buy-in. If this was going to work, we didn't want this to feel like something Victor implemented and we just had to live with it. Our software engineers needed to feel like the end result was theirs. Not something imposed, not something slipped in quietly, something they actually owned. We left the ADR open for discussion for about 4 weeks. This was longer than any ADR we'd done before. We wanted time for people to read it, question it, disagree with it, and sit with it. The goal wasn't fast approval, the goal was shared understanding. Next, we made a deliberate decision about reviews. Every pull request related to this ADR would be reviewed by the four tech leads from each product group. They did two things. First, it made sure they were genuinely on board. Second, it meant their teams were represented, not surprised later. Surprises are great for birthdays, not for architecture. Architecture stopped being something decided by one person and started being something carried by the org. We also didn't want the implementation to be rushed. The work followed our normal design process and we made progress visible to everyone. That visibility turned a risky architectural shift into a series of small, understandable steps. Now at this point, it may seem like we were putting a lot of process in place. It probably sounds like we were saying, we need to have everything figured out before we start. And to be honest, that felt a little backwards. This first bounded context was supposed to be a pilot, not a well-engineered masterpiece. And a pilot is supposed to discover things, which means sometimes taking a step backward only to backtrack when things aren't working. If we already had all the answers, if we were able to lay out all the steps for this refactoring top to bottom, then we wouldn't need a pilot, right? This means we needed to do a POC, a proof of concept, to discover things that we didn't know about. The goal of the POC was to expose hidden coupling and understand which boundaries were actually possible. So I started with a proof of concept, not a full implementation, just a scaffold. The idea was simple. Create the basic shape of a bounded context. That means using some shared utilities for HTTP, some middleware, basic MySQL access, nothing fancy, just enough structure for a dummy hello world endpoint. Then I ran a dependency analysis, and that's where things got interesting. That simple scaffold was pulling in half our monolith. Not because the domain needed it, this hello world domain of the scaffold didn't need anything yet, but because all of these utility packages did. The glue code was the monolith. The things we thought were harmless helpers were actually acting like dependency magnets. And there was another issue hiding in plain sight, a got package. Anytime someone needed a new type and didn't know where it belonged, it went into this fleet package at the bottom. Over time, that large fleet package picked up its own dependencies, which were not shown on the previous slide, which meant everything that imported it picked those up too, And that's made circular dependencies incredibly easy to create and incredibly hard to reason about. That fleet package existed to make things easier, but it ended up doing the opposite. At that point, it became clear we couldn't just extract a bounded context right away. We were missing a layer. Before we could pull anything out, we needed a platform layer, code that handled infrastructure concerns, HTTP helpers, database wiring, middleware, without dragging domain assumptions along with it. We needed to differentiate between two types of code. Domain code should express business rules, and platform code should make those rules possible to run. Before we could modularize the domain, we had to modularize the foundation. Another issue we had to solve from our first attempt was that even with good documentation, even with ADRs, even with buy-in, nothing stops coupling from sneaking back in, especially in a large code base. And especially nowadays, when changes aren't only written by humans, but also by AI coding agents that optimize for make it work and not preserve architecture. Architecture that lives in people's heads doesn't scale, and it doesn't survive time. That's why we realized we needed architectural checks, sometimes known as fitness functions. Automated checks that run continuously, checks that don't care who wrote the code, human or AI. Specifically, we needed checks to enforce boundaries, which packages can depend on which, what the platform layers are allowed to import, what a bounded context is not allowed to import, because once those rules are explicit, they stop being simply opinions. They become executable. Now, all of that tooling matters, but let's circle back to the core problem we're trying to solve. Looking back, the real constraint wasn't Go, it wasn't MySQL, and it wasn't even the monolith. The real constraint was human attention, how much of a system one person can hold in their head and how confidently they can make a change. Once a system grows beyond that limit, progress slows, no matter how good the engineers are. We often talk about architecture as if it's for computers. But computers don't care how big your code base is, humans do. Architecture is really an interface for people. It defines what you need to understand, what you can safely ignore, and what you're allowed to change. When that interface is unclear, every change feels risky. When it's clear, people move faster, even in a large system. For a long time, I thought the hard part was architecture, or code, or tooling. It wasn't. The hardest part was alignment, shared language, shared understanding, and shared ownership. Modularization isn't really about modules. It's about respecting the limits of human attention and designing systems people can understand, trust, and change without fear. Tools matter, patterns matter, but architecture lasts only when it's owned by more than one person. So before I wrap up, I want to pause on these. These are some of the teams using Fleet in production today. They're very different organizations with very different constraints. We learned a lot from working with customers like these, and many of the lessons I talk about come from operating on this kind of scale under real conditions. That's it for this talk. If this story resonated with you, I'd love to hear about your own. Problems are rarely unique, even when the code bases are. Here's a few links about Fleet. We are hiring Go developers right now, and you can find some links about me. And thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.